And welcome to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. Welcome to the show. We have a great show for you today. We're going to feature two interviews from Radio EcoShock, which comes out of Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC, with Alex Smith. And Alex Smith interviewed Dr. Kiffer Card recently. And Dr. Card did a study where he looked at the massive heat wave that stalled over Western North America last June, in June of 2021, and especially, of course, in British Columbia, at least 600 people died in that massive heat wave, and the village of Lytton burned to the ground, if you remember that story. And a team of psychologists managed to survey people before and after this terrible heat dome. And so to explain this groundbreaking science is this co-author of this study, Dr. Kiffer Card, who is an assistant professor with the Faculty of Health Sciences at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. And Dr. Card is a social epidemiologist and director of the Mental Health and Climate Change Alliance. So here is that interview, which was featured on Radio EcoShock, and the interview is done by Alex Smith.
Do you suffer from climate anxiety? Do mental health problems increase when catastrophe strikes? We get a revealing new study into the mental health impacts of climate change. A test case arose in June 2021 when a massive heat wave stalled over Western North America. In British Columbia, Canada, over 700 people died in the event, and the village of Lytton burned to the ground. A team of psychologists managed to survey people both before and after this terrible heat dome. Here to explain groundbreaking science is co-author Dr. Kiffer Card. Kiffer Card, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
What does climate anxiety look like? How would we know if we or somebody we know is suffering from it?
Yeah, that's a great question. All of us, or at least many of us, have some worries about the environments we live in, whether that's pollution or some other source, and certainly many of us are worried about climate change. And I think climate anxiety is important to differentiate from worry. Worry is natural. We should be worried. Climate change poses considerable threats to our futures, to our lives. But anxiety takes that worry to the next level and starts to be disruptive in an individual's life. They start to have difficulty focusing on their work or schooling as a result of being preoccupied with thoughts about climate change. They're unable to concentrate on the things that are important to them and to seek out those opportunities for fulfillment and enjoyment that they would normally be able to enjoy if they weren't preoccupied. And so climate anxiety, as opposed to worry, is about the impairments or disruptions that thoughts and feelings about climate change in the future might cause an individual.
So once climate anxiety is stimulated, does it stop when the threatening event ends, or can it continue long after?
This is a great question, and there's likely some within-person variation in terms of how distressed individuals become and how long that perpetuates. Our study is designed to start looking at these questions of seeing, in the wake of natural disasters that raise people's awareness about climate change, such as the heat dome, the atmospheric rivers, and other environmental weather events that are linked to climate change cause. And so we would like to see that. In the case of the study that you mentioned, we looked at climate anxiety about 2 weeks after the heat dome, which is a relatively short period. Many news articles were still being run about the climate anxiety and about climate change itself. And so some of that is the immediate aftermath. And we would like to see over time, how does that dissipate and for whom? There are certainly vulnerabilities that we hypothesize would be associated with prolonged anxiety and distress, such as a generalized distress. If you're a person who already experiences a lot of stress in your life, then things like climate change and anxiety can sort of burrow in and stick with you. Whereas if your life kind of moves on past those events, then maybe it subsides over time. But I think that's one of the big questions that we're ready to move on to and start investigating is, how long does this impact? And also with the accelerating frequency and intensity of weather events related to climate change, will there be a compounding effect in that people who are anxious get more and more anxious as they see more and more of these events?
I would really like to see that research because scientists do predict that we will have multiple catastrophic events in the coming years. Now, when developing their climate change anxiety scale in 2020, two researchers, Clayton and Carassia, found what they called behavioral engagement is not related to climate anxiety or depression. I had to read through that a little bit. Does that mean learning about climate change does not necessarily lead to anxiety in students or in any of us? I'm kind of asking for a friend who does radio shows on climate.
Yeah, I think it's a really big challenge. It's something we're interested in to understand a little bit better, that connection. I think as we talk about climate anxiety on podcasts like this, on news networks, in schools, in classrooms, there's certainly the concern that talking about climate anxiety, dwelling on it, could increase people's level of anxiety, particularly if they don't have positive outlets by which they can actually do something about climate change. I think it's important to remember that stress is a natural human response. It's something we all do because our bodies are trying to send us messages. The stress in the form of hunger is to motivate you to eat. The stress in the form of thirst is motivate you to drink. The stress in the form of loneliness, which during the pandemic many of us are feeling, that's to motivate you to get out there and socially connect. With climate change, the stress that we fear and the forward-looking fear about what's going to happen to our homes, our environments, our families, our kids, our grandkids, occupations, all of that, it's difficult to find those positive outlets. And so I think that's a real big motivation here, is to find out how do we direct people's energies in positive and productive ways, not in ways that are debilitating or fatalist that limit people's action. And I think that finding you mentioned between behavioral engagement and climate anxiety is a really serious problem for us to consider in terms of how do we get people to find meaningful and fulfilling ways to express those anxieties and to get them out of their system, so to speak.
And are there treatments or even self-care that can help heal from climate anxiety?
There's a lot of emerging work in the U.S. and Canada and other jurisdictions that are trying to better understand what it is that therapists and counselors and communities can do to address climate anxiety. A lot of this work is really in its infancy, and in fact, it's a big motivating factor behind the research of the Mental Health and Climate Change Alliance is to better understand what we really do about this. We heard from college counselors and psychologists who say that they get inundated in the wake of these events with students who are experiencing these sort of concerns, and certainly that's mirrored and clinicians who work in other settings as well. And so there's an increasing challenge to figure out what it is we should actually be prescribing and telling people. You know, it doesn't help to tell people that, climate change, they needn't be worried. You know, I don't think that's an effective strategy. I don't think doing those sorts of things are going to work. And so we really do need to find that out. But again, this is a new area. You know, in Canada, for example, less than 1% of health funding goes to the study of climate change and its impacts on health. And for those reasons, we still are in the dark on a lot of these. I think also recognizing that organizations like the American Psychological Association, while they are recognizing the role of ecological anxiety or climate anxiety, still there's no formal diagnoses for these anxieties, and therefore treatment of them is difficult.
I hear you. I mean, in climate disasters, we count the deaths and maybe the hospitalizations, or there's a tally of the number of homes lost or insurance costs. But millions of people around the world have been traumatized by extreme weather events, and yet so little's known about the mental health impacts of climate change. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting question, something that a lot of my work is interested in. In general, we do see that, as you mentioned, there are certain indicators that we like to measure, right? We measure hospitalizations and deaths, and I mean, that's something you see in COVID. Something that's easy to count is easy to act on, and so we see those things. When it comes to the internal mental health states of individuals, those things are relatively more complex, and it becomes more difficult to work with them and treat them. There's also just histories in the medicalization of mental health. And you know, when you go to a doctor with a cold or with COVID, you have a specific treatment plan for that. When you go to a doctor with psychological distress, there's no necessary cause that brought you there that's well established, or there's no treatment plan that will be proven to be effective. And so I think mental health by its nature is just more complex, and that makes treatment of it more difficult. And so as a result, governments haven't really taken responsibility. If you think of medical health care coverage, even in Canada, you know, while we have a public healthcare system, we don't have anything near that level of support when it comes to people's mental health.
Well, you mentioned COVID-19, and people sure suffered a lot of anxiety about that at the same time as we had these fires and smoke and floods in other places in the world. It makes me think that we do need research to find out if anxiety from two concurrent causes might compound, and if so, would that be worse? Would it be more than the sum of its parts?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. I mean, for me also, thinking about the, you know, racial tensions in the U.S. with police shootings and those sort of things created a lot of stress. COVID's created a lot of stress. Climate change is creating a lot of stress. We've had a rough go these past 2 or 3 years in terms of our environments and social world creating a lot of stress for us. And I think it is important to understand those contributions. In our study, we actually did measure some levels of COVID stress. And while this wasn't included in the published paper, we did monitor levels of COVID-related anxiety, and just to make sure that that level of anxiety stayed stable while we saw increases in the levels of climate anxiety, because there was no new developments in the coronavirus world during that time. So, you know, we wanted to make sure that we weren't just getting a base level of increased anxiety between those two time points.
And what about anxiety for others, like being afraid our aging parent might die in the next heat wave or that our grandchildren's future will be pretty rotten? Does that count?
Yeah, I think in terms of what climate change is contributing to, we have a number of papers currently in production looking at the various outlets that climate anxiety affects, you know, such as the decision to have children. We see that climate anxiety is having a significant impact amongst people who don't have kids as to whether or not they want to have kids. We also are looking at its impact and fear of regional devastation, and we see that climate anxiety is a driving worry. Here in BC, we have many forested communities, and those are vulnerable, of course, to wildfire. And so that's going to influence where people live. And then the occupations that people choose. We're looking at climate anxiety and occupation and what occupations people choose to go into. You know, a resource extraction-based economy, for example, might face difficulties in the future attracting people into that industry if people are worried that industry is going to be affected by either climate change itself or the policies meant to mitigate it. And so I think in many ways, climate change is affecting all of these fundamental aspects of life, whether you have a family, where you live, what you do for a living. And so I think the worries are pretty widespread in terms of what, and I think that can include, you know, worry for a heat wave, you know, affecting somebody close to you, particularly if you don't have the benefits and luxuries and privileges of things like air conditioning or even shelter.
I have to ask, when you took your first survey on climate anxiety, that was before the heat dome and you could not have known that was coming. Was that just luck?
Yeah, I like to say I'm not a meteorologist. I don't really know all that much about weather. My, you know, work mostly focuses on health and health behavior. And so it really was just lucky. We formed the Mental Health and Climate Change Alliance in February of last year and really brought together a group of about 120 community members, experts, policymakers to help us establish a bit of a research agenda. From that, from those conversations, we developed the Climate Distress Monitoring System, which is this survey that was meant. And in just prior to the heat dome, we had piloted it. We were just testing to see, you know, can you measure climate anxiety? Do you get a good representative sample? Who do you miss out on? Those sorts of questions about just the functions of what does it look like to try to monitor and measure this? Because as I mentioned, if you measure something, then you can, you know, get policymakers to act on it. And so we ended up actually closing the survey because we had kind of recruited the sample size that our analyses told us we needed to do what we wanted to do. And then the heat dome hit. And so we realized, well, this is a perfect opportunity to really test and see how this works in real time. And so we took advantage of course, what was a difficult event for many who not only suffered, but also people who lost loved ones due to the heat waves and their hometowns. But for us, it was fortuitous to be able to demonstrate that, you know, climate change isn't something that's just going to impact our health 50 years from now, that it's actually impacting our health now.
So people did report after that heat dome that they were not feeling as good mentally.
Yeah, about 60% or so said that first they were directly impacted by the heat dome. And of course, heat you know, in BC, where many people don't have air conditioners or they're out traveling, that's an effect. And then about the same number, about two-thirds of folks said that their mental health was worsened. And that was, again, validated by the data from the climate change anxiety scale, in which we see that the average level of climate change anxiety increased by 13% after the heat dome compared to prior.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Canadian social epidemiologist Dr. Kiffer Card. We're talking about new research into climate anxiety. Now, here's something else. Maybe it needs new research, but can climate anxiety spread from one person to another and so run through much of the population? For example, people on the East Coast or the UK who did not experience the 2021 heat dome may still feel anxious hearing news about it.
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. Again, that's something that we look forward to looking at. We do want to expand our climate distress monitoring system nationwide here in Canada, and we've applied for federal funding to support that effort and hopefully be able to, you know, look across regions and provinces and see, you know, do the heat events on the West Coast impact anxiety on the East Coast? Certainly there's information ecosystems people hear about through news media, through social media, about what's going on, and all of that has a potential to increase anxiety, even if you're not directly impacted. But certainly there are vulnerabilities that are inherent to being in a certain region. And so we don't know that the types of anxieties that people experience in one part of the world necessarily will translate. But I think there's good reason to believe that, yeah, there is probably a bit of that social contagion, and that people who worry about climate change or who are prone to worry may get those feelings awakened if something happens even far away from them. And so we want to look geographically and over time how these anxieties in different areas might play out in response to weather events.
Some scientists and environmentalists wonder if climate anxiety becomes widespread, there might be enough support and demand for real action by governments and corporations and people. But is it possible if the whole herd is nervous, it could go the other way, stimulating a general denial and opposition to action or even talking about it?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think there certainly is a bit of backlash. I think there's lots of research around the sort of tensions about what convinces people whether climate change is real and effective. I think one of the major challenges for climate change is we've got a real lack of serious international collaboration, and that, you know, the national determined contributions outlined in the Paris Agreement and subsequent climate accords, those are insufficient. I think as long as each country is trying to minimize its own contributions while hoping others carry that load, I think that's a really big trouble. So the question of whether or not there's real democratic solutions for climate change, I think, is an interesting question in and of itself. And, you know, how individual populations might, you know, come in as a backlash against that, I think it's really important for governments to be thinking about that now, particularly as they envision just transitions for people employed in resource extraction jobs, such as forestry or energy, and to ensure that there's suitable engagement with those communities, that there's supports for when those jobs do transition, and that there's ability to support people finding new occupations. And so I think some of those effects can be managed, hopefully, but you have to be thinking about how are people responding to climate change and the policies that governments implement, and are you really earnestly trying to address those needs? And hopefully if we do, here in BC, I think there is a strong commitment in our government to support, you know, forestry communities and other resource communities. But, of course, there's lots of challenges to doing that well.
Kiffer, is the Mental Health and Climate Change Alliance primarily about research guidance and policy advice, or does it also have a public face where, say, listeners could interact in some way?
Right now, I think we are mostly just the former. We are predominantly a group of researchers throughout Canada, some in the U.S., who are really hoping to mobilize those sort of resources. We work with a number of community-based organizations and who do kind of more public-facing work. But Our real mission is to, you know, create the knowledge that's necessary to activate responses amongst governments, to provide expert guidance on treatment and therapy for clinicians and therapists, and then ultimately to evaluate those and identify the most effective approaches. And so through that work, we would like to, you know, be able to provide more public-facing website, but we're still, you know, fairly new organization on the scene. A lot of this work, as we've kind of talked about today, is still a lot of unknowns. And so we need to really understand the realities of the situation before we can start trying to actually do something about it.
In the news, we see over and over again how the COVID pandemic has a worn-out public that can turn into anger and violent protests in both Europe and North America. Do you think it's possible that the mental stress of continuing climate change over decades could harm social institutions or civilization?
Yeah, I think that is possible. We do see that this is a highly polarized issue in that political affiliation appears to be an important driver of climate anxiety, with people who are more on the left progressive side of the spectrum being more worried about climate change than those who are on right. And I think if we just look back by analogy in the declines of trust in institutions, that we see that in cases when progressive policies aren't really acted out well, when we don't fulfill the promises we make, then I think that creates a bit of backlash. It creates a bit of fatalism, and people begin to distrust the institutions that promise so much but deliver so little. And so I would certainly be worried that that would happen, both amongst conservatives and liberals who view the government as either incapable or unwilling to take action to protect their interests. And those interests are diverse, right? For different communities, that is going to mean something different.
Do you have suggestions where listeners can go to learn more about how to cope with climate anxiety or to help others they know?
Yeah, I think both the American Psychological Association and the Canadian Psychological Association are developing out resources and have some resources. I think is really where a lot of this is leading out is community-based organizations that deal in climate activism. The sort of social support that people have providing is really, really, I think, key. So finding people who you can talk to this about, that strong social networks is how you build resilience. And so I think that's a critical piece here.
As we wrap up here, Kiffer, you've studied many other issues, including addiction research in depth. What brought you into mental health and climate, and where do you see the field going?
Yeah, I think my interest, as a social epidemiologist is really in understanding the distributions and determinants of many health conditions. And my interest is really in these, what we call syndemic conditions, things that reinforce each other. And so, you know, mental health and substance use, COVID and substance use or mental health, right? All of these things really interact with one another. And I think really my work is aiming to better understand what are the common underlying problems that we face in society that relates to all of these syndemic effects. And so issues such as social connection being a solution for climate anxiety, for substance use disorders. You know, we think of like self-help groups and substance use, for example, as being really kind of critical and important. And your social network having a strong influence in terms of motivating substance use and addiction and allowing you to recover from it. And so I think the key here is to figure out what are really these common fundamental causes of the health problems we face, and then how do we mobilize the system to respond in a way that addresses all of these things at once. You know, I've always believed in that saying that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And I think we really do need to take a more prevention mindset in public health and medicine to figure out how can we organize our society in such a way to prevent all of these things rather than treating them on the front line with doctors, nurses, and medications.
From Simon Fraser University in Canada, we've been speaking with social epidemiologist Dr. Kiffer Card. Check out kiffercard.com or follow links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Kiffer, thank you for sharing this on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith.
And that was an interview with Dr. Kiffer Card, who is an assistant professor with the Faculty of Health Sciences at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. And Dr. Card is a social epidemiologist and director of the Mental Health and Climate Change Alliance. He was talking about a study where a team of psychologists managed to survey people before and after the massive heat wave that stalled over Western North America. And in British Columbia, of course, you may remember even the village of Lytton burned to the ground, which was in part due to this heat wave. Record-breaking hot temperatures. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Ryan Young, and we have another interview, which we are going to feature now from Radio EcoShock. And that interview that Alex Smith is also doing is with a 40-year Yukon veteran, Radio Rob Hopkins. Radio Rob Hopkins, of course, is a radio broadcaster in the Yukon Territory. And from a village on a lake south of Whitehorse, Rob Hopkins and his volunteer crew broadcast to the tiny community of Tagish, Yukon. And Rob also helped to establish the community radio station in Yukon's capital city of Whitehorse on CJUC 92.5 FM. So I think Alex Smith wanted to check in with somebody who lives in the far north of Canada because the north is warming. It's already above the 2-degree warming danger mark, and even, according to Alex Smith, 4.3 degrees Celsius warmer in winter. So they're going to talk about the North's dependence on fossil fuels and efforts to get fracking going there. So, something a little bit different on Radio EcoShock and here on Ecolibrium. Let's listen to Alex Smith's interview with Radio Rob Hopkins, who lives in the Yukon Territory.
From the Yukon, Rob Hopkins, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, nice to meet everybody out there. Hello, Alex.
So you're the other Rob Hopkins. I tend to think of the transition guy, but you're sort of Radio Rob in the Yukon, I gather.
Yeah, Radio Rob. I've been working in communication 30 years now. I live in a small community 120 kilometers southwest of Whitehorse.
I suppose most people living in Canada's north experience climate changes. What is most noticeable in the Yukon, would you say?
40 years ago, when I first came here, you would get minus 40 below Celsius for 3 weeks in November, and then cold all through the winter. And then that changed, the 25 years ago, that you'd end up with no 40 below before December, and you'd get 40 below stretch in January. And there's been in recent years, it hasn't even gone to 30 below a couple of years here, which was really strange. And, you talk to First Nation elders and they tell it's all part of a pattern that this has happened in the past. But some of the stuff that I see right now that's happening and for environmental issues in here is a lot of Canadians think the North is all green and everybody's pumping money into this and results. But actually, I think there's more pollution being generated with the money that's coming from Ottawa here rather than trying to fix things or creating more problems for the environment.
Well, one part of that, I guess, is the mining. And you mentioned to me in an email that there certainly have been problems.
Right. Mining's a backbone of the Yukon industry. And if it's done properly, resource extraction, then it's not a problem. But time and time again, we see the same model happening in the north. Somebody comes in that wants to set up a mine. There's supposed to be security deposits and environmental compliance. And so these mines operate all loosey-goosey. The government looks the other way. And then when the mine has extracted all the money out of the territory, then the mine just says, well, we're bankrupt and we're going to leave. And the Yukon taxpayers is left holding the bag. But what's happened is the mine has actually taken the money out. The government people have got their cut. We're left holding these ugly resources. And some of these companies aren't even Canadian. We wine and dine Chinese companies to come here and invest. They come here, they take the money out, they leave an environmental mess.
Let's get to climate change again. Officially, the Yukon is already above the 2-degree warming danger mark, and even 4.3 degrees C warmer in the winter, just since 1948. That's a huge change. So you're one of the world's hotspots and already past the UN goals set for the end of the century. Millions of people further south think if the weather gets too hot, that the rest of us will just move up to the Arctic. I don't think that would work out.
No, this is terrible. You're right. We know it up here. We get climate change, all kinds of things happening. But I take a look at what's happening down in southern Canada and down in the United States. Yes, it's going to be cooking down there. It already is cooking. It's way too hot. We're seeing that up here. And some of the stuff which is really difficult to describe to Canadians and people from outside the world. They see the Yukon is a big pristine wilderness and untouched beauty. And yeah, you drive on the highways here, they're all the trees are clear cut. There's huge carbon heat sinks being created. Whitehorse is, you just look at it on a map, it's one big piece of asphalt now. And it's very, very bad for the environment to be able to go in and into nature and disrupt it like that. Some of the other effects that we're seeing, is flooding here and on and on. Last year we had a major flood. This year the ground is already saturated. The same thing is going to happen. We're going to see major flooding here. Glaciers melting, definitely warming up. No question about that.
Well, scientists on the show have told us that the Arctic will just get wetter and wetter, and rains that used to fall on the southern croplands get pulled further north. And for wildlife and First Nations hunters, that just isn't good news.
Right. The predictions here, and I can say in the area that I live in, the Yukon, is milder winters and wetter, damper summertime.
Does the Yukon have oil and gas industries, Rob?
There's a little bit of that has been going on. There's some controversy. The Yukon government has been pushing fracking. There was a huge public backlash to that. But anyhow, the government and Yukon Energy Corp, the sole provider of energy in the Yukon, is all gung-ho to get into fracking. And, they've all publicly said, oh, they're not doing this. But take a look at the infrastructure. What do? We spent $40 million on a LNG plant to power the Yukon. Another announcement that just came on the radio, we're setting up green charging stations. Everybody's going green, environmental, switch to electricity. Where's the electricity come from? All we're doing is just bringing more generator shacks in and setting them up beside the highway. So there is no long-term environmental plans for resource-friendly energy.
Well, does the government of the Yukon have a plan for cutting their emissions and sustainability?
No. Yukon government, there's some good people that work there. Most people just want their pensions and move on.
I wonder how Canadians will heat their homes without fossil fuels. It will take a lot of electric power, and we can double or triple that for the Yukon. Does the far north have more rivers that could provide hydro, or what about wind, lots of wind? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I work in communications, and part of the stuff is mountaintop sites and generating power, and that's always the enigma. That they've done wind studies in the Yukon, debacles on and on. They've built wind farms and research centers, and they've tore the last one down. They're putting another windmill back up, there isn't a real plan on long-term energy generation here. Nothing besides just a bunch of meetings from the government. There isn't any real action.
The Canadian Broadcasting Network, the CBC, just ran a feature story about the remote First Nations community of Old Crow getting off diesel with solar, but of course, solar only works for a few months when there's lots of sunlight in the Arctic.
Right. I've been to Old Crow. Old Crow's a really neat place, one of the longest continuously inhabited settlements in North America, the Bluefish Caves. Anyhow, all isolated, if you can imagine having to fly in every single thing that you need in your house or your community. So building materials, fuel, ATV parts, every single thing comes in by air. So getting off of diesel there, anything you can do will save tremendously on that. But as you point out, some of the northern communities, Old Crow stays really, really dark. But, how can you generate power when there's no sun? That's just not sustainable.
We've also heard about astronomical grocery prices in the north and just general living costs. And now we have this pandemic and there's supply chain issues and all of that. How are people doing?
Boy, you know, the Yukon, we are lucky because we're connected to the highway system to southern Canada. You know, there's some disruptions just generally with supply chain, but I really wonder about some of the other communities I've spent time in the far north, you know, Cambridge Bay, Kugluktuk, Kalawit, Nunavut, all those remote communities, the price of groceries there is staggering. And what's really difficult with those places, talk about food supply issues, you have to order your groceries 1 year in advance, pay everything in advance, and then put it on a barge. And a year later, your groceries arrive on a barge. And if you don't do that, then you're at the whim of going to the local store, and then you're going to start paying $35 for a 4-liter jug of milk and $16 for a box of cereal. So yes, food security issues, very, very difficult in those remote communities.
I'm Alex Smith, and from the Yukon in Canada's north, we are speaking with Radio Rob Hopkins, known for do-it-yourself radio and television broadcasting, among other things. So our listeners on the West Coast, we have quite a few stations, for example, in California and Oregon, and in Australia, they've suffered through massive wildfires and smoke in the recent years. What's the fire situation in the Yukon? And by the way, does the government have the resources to fight these wildfires?
Good question, Alex. Previous lifetime, I worked for the Forestry Department. I was a radio operator. That's where I got my Radio Rob handle, and worked on some huge fires that we had here. And the last couple of years has not been bad for fires. But my business, I supply emergency alerting equipment for the broadcast sector, and I have clients all over Canada. And one of my clients is the First Nation down in Williams Lake, the Chilcotin First Nation, and they had record fires 2 years in a row. And I was all part of that effort, setting up local radio stations so they could provide messaging to their citizens in off-grid communities. The amount of devastation that comes from those fires, you know, no matter who's in charge or how much money you have in it, Mother Nature, you don't stand a chance. You don't stand a chance on that. And one of the things that I found really interesting that happened after those big fires in Williams Lake area was it burned all the mountains, burned all the trees and everything. And then the next year and years after that, now what's happening is when it rains, there's no ground to soak up any of the moisture. So now we're going to see big flooding happening and flash floods and stuff. So yeah, it's fire's a big issue here.
Well, with some of the fires in the boreal forests in the north, people used to say, well, it doesn't matter that much because they'll regrow and they'll recapture that carbon. Well, maybe they will a couple of decades later, but some of the places, if they get burned over within 5 years, it kind of kills off the seeds, sterilizes the soil, and they may not regrow. They may convert into scrub or something else. So it looks like the North now, from what I've heard in the latest science, is becoming a carbon source rather than a carbon sink, even though it's getting wetter.
Yeah, there's methane gas being released too. That's a big issue. That could be a huge trigger for some catastrophe and stuff. It'd be right up your alley on your show, Alec.
Well, I have covered methane. There's two different worries. One of them is that you could get a burp of methane coming up from under the seabed, say off East Siberia, and that's been tracked for some years. Hasn't happened. Maybe could happen. We don't know. But what we do know is happening is the permafrost. Wherever those little lakes form all across the thawing permafrost, they're called thermokarst, then you get methane coming up instead of carbon dioxide. And as we know, it's 80 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. So that's where I think the first big methane challenge out of the Arctic is going to come. It's going to come from the permafrost.
Yeah, definitely. I want to just back up on something about Indigenous and power stuff. So here we go. With power generation, there is some interesting news, though, with the First Nation in Atlin, the Taku River Tlingit. They're one of the only First Nation governments in the world that actually own their own power production unit. And they right now they have a 4-megawatt hydro dam, and there's plans to expand that to 10 megawatts and to hook that up into the Yukon grid. So there is some activity with hydro generation here.
You know, it's amazing what you're doing. Tell us about your own broadcasting in the north and the new documentary coming out about you.
Yeah, boy, where do I start on that?
Well, what are you doing with your radio station? Why don't you start with your radio station and we'll work out from that?
I've been a broadcaster in the Yukon Territory now 25 years. I do this out of my small community of Tagish. I have the first commercial FM radio station in the Yukon, 106.7 FM, and that is call sign CFET. And any of my software runs on different radio stations, including the radio station and Whitehorse. So I provide emergency alerting systems that tie in with the national Telmarec system. So if there's a flash flood or there's a fire, then my systems will receive that information and automatically cut it in and broadcast it to local communities. I'm the only manufacturer of this equipment in Canada that also supports Indigenous languages. So in remote communities, when an emergency alert comes out, it will say in the local dialect, you know, there's a flood or there's a fire, and then the English message after that.
That's just brilliant. You know, it is amazing that an individual can become a broadcaster, really. I mean, before I did Radio EcoShock on the airwaves, I did it as a 24-hour net station for 3 years on a computer running out of my living room using radio automation software that wasn't that expensive. So what sort of advice would you offer to listeners who want to spread their message?
How to get your message out? That's a good question. Where I saw all this stuff coming years ago was with social media and being bombarded with all this information. How do you know what's real? Right now, you can go to Facebook and good luck, man. But what I do like about radio does have trust involved in it. If I listen to a radio show in the morning and I know the person that's saying it, I go, hey, at least I know who that person is. It's not just some robot somewhere. So there's some level of trust that makes radio relevant today. And, I love old radio. I love old technology. I like squeezing the life out of old technology and making it still work. And radio is still used not just in North America, but all over the world.
Well, we've talked about some of the problems of the North, but there must be a lot of great things about living there or you wouldn't be there. What are some of the benefits of being a true North Canadian?
The North is a great place to live. Don't get me wrong. The cities, I'm not going to say they're slums, but they're definitely not representative of the rural Yukon, the real Yukon. And, it's just like any other big city. Yeah, like today was great. I was doing some work at my office. I looked outside and there's a moose eating a bunch of branches. And then there's a fox looking at me in the other window. We have lots of elbow room here, wide open spaces. This is a real luxury right now. I wouldn't want to be stuck in downtown Toronto or Vancouver, that's for sure.
Well, I went and built a home in what we call the North, but you'd just call it the far south. But anyway, it was cold enough. But one of the advantages there was lots of cheap land, lots of room, and no building inspectors. So you just built whatever you could, and they were glad to see if you could survive there. So I don't know if it's like that still in the North, but there's a lot of freedom and space that comes with it that if you go to a place like India where there's packed people everywhere you go, even if you're in the woods, there's several people around you collecting things. It's a different feel that Canadians have, I think.
For sure. And, some of the things that happens here, especially you see this over time, progress, change, always going to happen. There's lots of people that come here, get away, want to see the wilderness. There's lots of people come here, they want to get away from whatever place they just left, Burnaby or Mississauga, and they want to leave all that stuff behind. And what happens is they miss whatever they left behind, and then they want to recreate the problem that they left in the Yukon. And so you end up with a mess like Whitehorse with all these brought in failed models, and all of a sudden everybody says, hey, we got to do all this stuff, and then it's rules and regulations, and that affects us out in the rural Yukon. Now we have policies that are being made by people that don't even live in the Yukon. You can be a Yukon government employee, you don't even have to work, you don't even have to live in the Yukon, for crying out loud.
What are some of the international environment issues that catch your attention, Rob Hopkins?
Yeah, interesting. I travel around a lot. 30 years, Yukon's my base, but I spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia, been to China lots, over 30 years, seeing amazing stuff that's happened over there. China, boy, they want to take over the planet. Absolutely. They're plotting and scheming right now, but their plan is not to take over a toxified planet. So they're actually doing quite well in electronic EV stuff, you know, protecting the environment. They still turn a blind eye to lots of other stuff, but like I say, they have a plan. When I was there, they have electric motorcycles, electric cars everywhere. Half of the motorcycles are electric now, and they're really good because they don't use any noise, but they're bad because you can't hear them. You get hit by them on the street. The other thing which I thought amazing in all the electric stuff in China was people think you need to have charging stations and huge infrastructure and stuff. Yeah, to plug your electric motorcycle in, you just have one of those little chargers like you have right now. You just plug in the wall. It wasn't anything big. Thailand, before 30 years ago, big messes everywhere, garbage all over the place. They changed their culture. They said, hey, we're gonna clean up this mess. We don't want to leave messes all over the place. When I was in Nan, a small town, they had garbage pickup twice a day at houses, and every shop has recycling stuff. They had standardized containers for recycling. This is where you put your bottles. This is where you put your glass. So they're really, really smart on that. They've done this not because the government has forced them to. They've done it because they have to. And if you just make a huge mess like we do in North America, you'll have no room in your village for anything. You'll just have a pile of rubbish around your place. So they're very, very resourceful in how to manage waste and how to recycle stuff to the max. Like the stuff that we throw out in the garbage here in North America, that feeds a family of four for months and stuff. Just as an example on our waste here. Everything that we can do to help the environment is good, and setting a good example and making it attractive to recycle. But beating people over the head with a big stick and telling them they have to recycle, that's a bad way to get any policy.
Yes, when I was in India, children were selling peanuts by the side of the road, and they were doing it in the pages of exercise books that students had used. So they're recycling that paper because there's no way they're going to go out and get brand new paper to sell peanuts by the street.
So, for example, in the film that you see, Alex, I'm building a TV station from stuff that I found in the dump. That's the premise of the film. And recycled radio raw. That was filmed about 2 years ago in the dump. And I'm in a small town, 300 people. There's a place where you throw your rubbish into a pit and a recyclable bin and a cardboard thing. So that's now all changed now. That's, again, this is a town of 300 people, less than 300. So now we have a gate on it. We have security, we have buildings on it, we have 24-hour lighting that illuminates the whole sky. Here you can't see stars now. And anyhow, we have a whole infrastructure now of government employees that are managing the dump. If there's a free store, you have to pay for everything that you take to the dump now. Recycling is not encouraged at all. There's a free store. It's in the film, Tiffany's Free Store. So it's not a free store anymore. If you want to take something to the free store, they put it on a scale and they charge you to take stuff to the free store. No encouragement for recycling here at all. Yeah, very, very bad.
I think that what we will have to do is just end the fossil fuel economy one way or another. And if we don't do it willingly and with a long-term plan, then nature will do it for us with catastrophe after catastrophe that just knocks out the infrastructure. So I'm hoping we do the former and that we get our act together.
Yeah, me too. And, I do see examples of things that work. I wish we would copy more positive models. And rather than going down the road of messes and stuff, there's great hope for mankind if we can get our act together. A CFET radio station here, running on that thing. And there's a community radio station in Whitehorse that I'm involved in. I set it up, it is me, but it's a community radio station. So I'll give you the link to the community radio station in Whitehorse, and you can listen to, you can send that link out there.
I appreciate that. I'll put that in my blog, and thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Rob. It was great to meet you.
Yeah, thanks again for all the information and stuff that you've been providing. Boy, if I feel depressed, I listen to your show, I'm happier way at the end there. When I hear about stories in the Arctic, I think about what do people down south, what is their thoughts about the Arctic? When they hear things, you know, they've watched TV movies and all this stuff and great expanses. And yeah, that's all there. But there's like the environmental stuff that's happening here and some of the things that man-made. When I came here, Alex, was in 1982, before I was a hobo, hop trains. I came up here in 1982. Now, the day I got here was the day they shut the railway down. And the reason they shut the railway down is the mine in Faroe had shut down. That was like the largest copper mine going in the world. And it shut down. The entire economy just flattened right out, never really recovered in that scale of a project. But that mine up there, that's our Fort McMurray. There's a big mess out there. It's going to take billions of dollars to get that remediation back to wherever. And the people that ran the mine now, they've all since retired, bonuses paid. We're on the hook for it. And when I say we, it's the people in Ottawa that are paying for the Yukon. We get $2 billion a year transfer payments. Those transfer payments are from Ottawa to keep the Yukon going. If those transfer payments go, then what does the Yukon have left in it? But there's lots of ongoing environmental things, and happy to share that stuff with you forever. The latest thing in the news was the PCR COVID tests. The people have been asking for them at Christmas time, teachers, students, what are we going to do? And we just found out that the Yukon government gave half of their PCR tests to the mining industry. And the mining industry, and this is before Christmas, and then the mining industry comes back and says, we already have our own tests. They didn't even know anything about these things. So it tells you where their priorities are at.
Oh, man. Yeah. So you're running Radio EcoShock from time to time in the Yukon. Is that how it's working?
It plays in Tagish. It plays Sunday at 1 o'clock. And if it doesn't play, then I get people call me and get a hold of me and go, hey, what the hell? Where's Alex? That's the most important thing to listen to of the week. I'm serious, actually. And that runs in Whitehorse, Tagish, and Whitehorse and the city and stuff. Yeah, no, I get that a lot.
Radio EcoShock, providing hard truths to inform citizens and activists. Follow up at ecoshock.org. Yukon broadcaster Rob Hopkins with more on the environment and life in the far north.
The royalties are on mining. It's crazy here. It's crazy how much money we get in royalties from gold. Less than 35 cents an ounce is what the royalty rate is here. On $1,800 U.S. ounce of gold, we get less than 35 cents. What's wrong with that picture? Yeah, right now, the topic is people's power bills have come in. And, it was a cold December and January, and all of a sudden people are going, they're doubled. I'm seeing on Facebook, people in Whitehorse, they're paying like $1,000 a month for their power bill. Like $1,000, I pay $80 a month here, $100 in the winter time and stuff. But how could you spend $1,000? I know why, because they got sucked into electric heat. The government tried to greenwash everything and said, oh, we want to get everybody off of diesel. And, we want to get everybody onto electricity. And now they're saying, well, now we don't have any power and we got to bring in more generators. And yeah, who knows what's going to happen on that. That's a big issue. But what's underlying on that most people do not know, and I've just learned about this just recently. So I'm part of the utilities consumer group. And I'm the president there, and it's a lobby group looking out for consumers' interests, mostly in telecom and power. And yeah, we've been at rate hearings forever and 30 years of this. And one of the big issues in Tagish now, 20 years now that I've been here involved in this issue, is the Yukon Energy is the sole provider of electricity. They have a dam in Whitehorse, and they want to raise the lake level here 10%. And or some height, and it's gonna generate a little bit. It's gonna like 2 or 3% extra power. It's going to have more reserves to go through the winter time and stuff. So anyhow, that's the project. And the First Nation have not been on board on this on a number of fronts, and neither have a lot of the people out here. And it's one of these meetings, everybody goes and the government says, oh, we got support. And they say, well, who supports it? Not one person in the room will say that they support it. But anyhow, the environmental issue to this is it's going to wipe out all the wildlife along the lakeshore, get rid of a whole bunch of swamps, all kinds of stuff is going to disappear. And the reason why they didn't go with this rate increase to include all this year, because we had flooding. This would be the bad time to start talking about raising the lake level when people are, their houses are 2 feet underwater and stuff. So that's another issue. When I've been at these hearings, I've asked till I'm blue in the face, man, like my shirt here. And I said, okay, you've got all the computer systems in the world. You've got all the resources. You've got everything. Tell me about your largest customer, right? And everybody looks around at each other. Oh, geez, we don't have that information. We don't know who our largest customer would possibly be, right? Or any of their usage or how they work. And I say, so you're telling me not even your accounting person could generate a report telling me who your largest user is and when they're using it? Of course, it's the Yukon government. And my point is that we have acres and acres of heated lit office buildings running 24 hours a day while there's homeless people on the street at minus 40. And why do we have such waste in our government buildings? As one example, the amount of greenhouse gases that generates to heat an empty building for people that don't even have a job that should be in that building. It's madness. It's madness.
From Tagish, Yukon, we have been speaking with Radio Rob Hopkins, longtime independent broadcaster in the north and helping people in many places.
And that was an interview from Radio EcoShock, which comes out of Co-op Radio in Vancouver, BC. And that was Alex Smith interviewing Radio Rob Hopkins from the Yukon, where he is quite the legend in the world of radio. And Alex Smith was interviewing him about trends in the north that have to do with fossil fuels and a warming climate. So thanks for listening here to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're all out of time now, and you can always email us with suggestions or comments to equilibrium@ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/EquilibriumCKUT Montreal. And we do have a small website, which is equilibriumradio.weebly.com. And we have an affiliated podcast on Spotify, which is called the Equilibrium Radio Podcast. So my name is Ryan Young, and we're going to leave you with some music. We're going to leave you with an old tune called The 12th Street Rag. And this is by Roy Clark, the amazing lightning-fast guitar player Roy Clark. We'll be right back.
to twang. This is why we hate. This is why we hate. Seek a fish and never hate. 90.3 ever at why? Why? This is why we hate. This is why we hate. Seek a fish ever hate. 90.3 ever at why? Why? Girls, them love me, so them know, say we act. We listen to the station, this a station, well act. Hear good music, this is why they act.
Yo, this is Junior Reed, and when I'm in Montreal, I stay tuned to C-Cut 90.3 FM. Montreal, stay alive. The music, the music, the music.
System is a strain and a mess. I feel it like a pain in my chest. The people need a rest. I feel like I can't breathe. In a this a suffocation. The people living in a suffocation. I can't breathe. I can't breathe.
Feels the beat.
Wait a minute, that's too fast.
Now what?
Kick it over here, baby pop!
CKUT, yo. Yo, this is for your mind, soul, and spirit. Plus your positive vibes. Masters at work, you gotta hear it. And West Indian rhythms on Saturday night. Roots, rock, reggae, I keep it tight. Man, child, hitting switches, keep it right. Disciple on a Friday. Psalms of soul, I do it my way. With ill groove on Sunday, I gotta say one way. We stick together, it's for unity.